After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Metta Hour with Sharon Salzberg, where Buddhist wisdom meets everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network and features interviews with the top leaders, teachers, and thinkers of the mindfulness movement and beyond. For more information, visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Sharon.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and today I'm joined by Mark Lesser. Mark is a speaker, facilitator, workshop leader, and executive coach. He's known for his engaging experiential presentations that integrate mindfulness and emotional intelligence practices and training. Mark is the author of 4 books, including 7 Practices of a Mindful Leader, Lessons from Google, and a Zen Monastery Kitchen. Mark was the co-founder and CEO of the Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute, featuring a mindfulness program he helped develop within Google. Mark founded and was CEO of 3 companies and has an MBA degree from New York University. Prior to his business and coaching career, he was a resident of the San Francisco Zen Center for 10 years and director of Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, the very first Zen monastery in the Western world. Welcome to the Metta Hour, Mark.
Thank you, Sharon. We don't get to hang out enough, so I'm glad we could use this as an excuse.
I know, it's fabulous. It's kind of like when you meet someone in, you know, India or something, and you say, well, we never get to see each other in New York, but here we are.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I'm trying to trace the course of your life. You went to NYU, got an MBA degree. Yay, NYU, yay, New York. Got an MBA degree.
No. My Zen training was before that.
It was before that. Oh, tell me, where was it?
Yeah. No, I was an undergraduate at Rutgers and took a 1-year leave of absence and went to San Francisco and found out shortly after that about the San Francisco Zen Center. Wandered in and stayed for 10
years.
Many surprising things happened during that time. But one was that I kept getting asked to take on different kind of management and leadership roles at the Zen Center, and I was always a little perplexed by that. But then, I think especially at the last my 9th and 10th years when I was running the head cook in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. At Tassajara and then director, I thought I'm liking this leadership stuff, and why isn't everyone integrating contemplative practice, mindfulness practice with work and leadership? So I went from there to NYU.
Oh, that's so interesting. I just made a very big assumption that it was the other way around.
Yeah, no, that's the more conventional way, I think, that people do it.
I don't know. That's fascinating because I really relate to that. Having, I went to India when I was 18, when I was a junior in college. I came back briefly and finished school and went back to India. I came back in 1974 as a teacher and began teaching after my own teachers had told me to teach. And then in 1976, we helped establish the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, which is still there and flourishing. And And that was another world, you know, suddenly it was like, I remember we have these board meetings and Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein and I would be there. And there was always somebody who said, you know, you're not budgeting correctly. You have to think about, you know, roofs leaking and things like that. And we'd say, really? You know, like, oh,
right.
That's different. And
right.
Everybody needs health insurance. Oh, really? And, you know, it was like another world. And it was fascinating for me in some funny way. I love business and just the way of trying to figure out how a value-based organization can flourish mm-hmm. and even survive
yeah.
in this mm-hmm. world. So I really understand what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, that, again, I'm still a little surprised in that, you know, when I was an undergraduate at Rutgers, I wouldn't have associated with people who were business yeah. majors. There was something bad about business. And then, and it's funny, the other day I was, I lectured at Green Gulch and during the question and answer, someone raised their hand and said, how could I be in the business world? Isn't it like so unethical? And aren't people just, you know, don't people just regularly, not tell the truth? And I was like, no, that's such an interesting, that business has such mm-hmm, a bad mm-hmm. reputation my experience is that it's mostly people, trying to do their best, trying to, you know, be as moral and ethical connected as they can. I actually think there's something, and I think this is partly maybe what you were saying, is that there's something about that energy in the business world that actually can offer something to people who are in the mindfulness world or in the contemplative world.
Well, in so many ways, it's like any manifestation. It's where the rubber meets the road, you know, and how are you going to structure things? How are you going to treat people who work there? How are you going to present yourself to the world at large in a way that's commensurate with your deepest values? And part of the problem, right, of course, right. with our experience of business or capitalism is that, for many organizations, many companies, there's a singular sense of responsibility, it seems, which is to please shareholders, you know,
mm-hmm,
it isn't necessarily the case that the entity, the business, has a sense of responsibility toward employees, toward the environment, toward the community, but mm-hmm. there's no reason it can't.
Right, right. Yeah, and thus the beauty of the creation of the B Corp, right, to actually create a legal entity to change the bylaws and articles of incorporation that so drove that mindset that you're referring to, that mindset of that the only priority was maximizing shareholder wealth and then to create a different structure. So I think that's, and I think there's a, boy, for many, whether it's the way that we've treated the environment and climate change, and I see it in, I think especially in millennials and young people, the need to align and integrate around work and business and money with values, with taking care of people. And there's still a long way to go, but I see that happening in a very profound ways.
Well, we were wondering if there was going to be anything controversial that we were going to find between us, but I mean, you must know that there's, you know, a fair amount of controversy about bringing mindfulness practices into businesses, into companies. I personally, you know, to the extent that I've done it, as I sometimes say, I've never been approached by somebody wanting to learn the practice who says to me, I'd like to be more of a soulless automaton, you know, and be more productive. I actually don't even like the word productivity. Or I wrote a book called Real Happiness at Work, and the publisher proposed it as part of the subtitle, and I said no. You know, I'm not about productivity. But instead, in businesses, people are people, you know, and they talk about their alcoholic brother or the trouble they have with their teenager or the fact that they feel, you know, they haven't slept in a very long time or they don't have funny balance or their unfair standards, you know, and that's the stress. That's the source of the suffering or the pain that people want to address. How much systemic change happens, you know, from people gathering these tools is a different question.
Yeah, no, I'm certainly very familiar with some of the controversy there. And I think, I think that businesses bring in, you know, mindfulness and contemplative practices for many motivations. Just like I think any individual practices with a variety of motivations. But what I keep finding is, you know, and I find myself in places like Google or SAP or within big medical systems like Kaiser, and I think there very much is a fundamental desire to find real connection, freedom, waking up, all of the same things that I think attract people to meditation places. I think that it's kind of amazing. I think that access and doors that are being opened to people to be able to practice who might never step into a more conventional practice center are finding out they're being introduced to practice in the workplace. Despite maybe the motivation of the people that brought us in was around, as you were saying, maybe it was, you know, how can we increase productivity? But more what I find, like in Google, mindfulness is a core part of their well-being program. And again, it's easy to be cynical, right? Being cynical is very easy, but I think there really is a question about how can we take care of our employees? How can we don't want our employees to be having negative reactions to stress. We actually care about their well-being, their physical, mental, spiritual health. And mindfulness seems to be something that very practical and accessible way to do that.
I think, and I'm sure you can tell, you know, having had so much experience, you know, that when you're brought in by an HR department that's kind of distant from the employees and doesn't really understand where they're at, or even worse, when it's like an enforced activity. And I can remember going into a company, and I think everybody in that room was sitting with their arms crossed against their chest. And they didn't look that happy to be there. And I said, do you have to like make up this time? Do you have to work later? And they all nodded their heads, you know. And I thought, I'll talk fast, you know. Or another time, you know, with another company where they said, you've got 15 minutes with each group. And I said, I can't do it in 15 minutes. And they said, but they've got to work. And I said, well, you know, can I have half an hour? Like, you know, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious when the motivation is really askew.
Yes. Yes. No, I've experienced some of that as well. But on the other end of the spectrum, I think about, you know, even to refer back to Google, where I have spent quite a bit of time, the program was always completely voluntary. In fact, it became somewhat competitive to get into the program, which is, and in fact, I was just at Google, and there's a pretty substantial waiting list for people wanting to take, and it's a 2-day program. So it's like that's not a lot of time, but it's not 15 minutes. It's like stepping out of your work life for two days. And then there's another, 4-week or 8-week kind of follow-up of doing daily practices. So I think there are more and more workplaces that are taking this stuff a lot more seriously and are seeing that it can really be important to take the time.
So you've written several books, and I'm curious about what's inspired this most recent book on the topic of leadership.
Yeah, well, most of the books I've written have been about this kind of integration, I think, of practice and work. And partly, this latest book, I've been reflecting a lot on how valuable and surprising my time was working and leading in a Zen monastery kitchen in the years mm-hmm. that I spent, at Tassajara. And that was always it's an interesting thing. I think especially, many contemplative practices, but Zen in particular, I think really emphasizes, work as practice. And even going back to, a piece of writing that Dogen, right, the founder of Zen in Japan in the 13th century, who wrote a piece called Instructions to the Head Cook, in which he, people think that this is a new idea, this idea of bringing mindfulness practice into the workplace. Well, no, this was, 800 years ago, Dogen wrote this beautiful piece and one of the things he said is that the head cook should always practice with three minds, with joyful mind, grandmother mind, and wise mind. And that to this day, the symbols and words for those three minds are on the altar in the center of the Tassajara kitchen, and there's often kind of talked about. And I feel in the work that I do these days, and this is part of, I think, what part of my own motivation to write my latest book was seeing that I was very consciously asking myself, how can I bring the experience that I got of the experience of working in a Zen monastery kitchen into the corporate world? And I felt like that was almost like the request that I was feeling was that how can we make mindfulness practice accessible to people in the work world without sacrificing the depth of it? We really want it in a more in-depth way. So that was my motivation, and really specifically, these particular seven practices that I write about in this book, they actually came from working with as I was working to train some Google employees, mostly engineers, on how to be mindfulness teachers. And I brought my friend, Zen teacher Norman mm-hmm. Fisher in, and Norman kind of spontaneously kind of came up with these particular seven practices.
Well, before we get into the seven, can you tell us what grandmother mind is?
Sure. I think grandmother mind is the mind of unconditional mm-hmm. love, right? Going back, it all goes back to your book mm-hmm. too, Sharon. Right. But this was, that you would bring in the mind of love. And I think, Dogen in this essay unpacks it as kind of taking care, loving every grain of rice, loving the food, loving the knives and implements, as well as, of course, loving the people that you're working with in the kitchen.
So do you see those three, have they become the seven?
In some way, I feel like they're certainly integrated. You know, the seven starts with love the work, and then do the work, and don't be an expert, and connect to your pain, connect to the pain of others, depend on others, and keep making it simpler. So lots of overlap, I think, between the three and the seven.
I love those seven. That's really great.
They're good. You know, it's funny. Part of the story on those is that when I brought Norman in to address this group of employees, I think it wasn't clear exactly what Norman was going to do, and there was on an agenda that I don't even know who created it, but it said, you know, Norman gives talk about bringing mindfulness into the world of work. And I kind of showed Norman, I was sitting next to him at this meeting at Google. And Norman very nonchalantly got out as Norman tends to do, a piece of paper and a pen. And he made some notes and proceeded to talk very eloquently about each of these seven practices as the core, you know, important practices that you need to know as a mindfulness teacher. But when I heard these, I thought I loved them. I loved them as soon as I heard them, and I actually wrote them down and put them on everyone's desk who was working at this organization, the Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute, that at the time I was the CEO of, and I put them on everyone's desk. We had about maybe 18 or 20 employees at the time. And then little by little, I started writing about them and teaching about these seven practices. And it was probably a couple of years into it that I started feeling funny about it and thought, I need to talk to Norman and get Norman's okay. Yeah. I think a book is emerging here. And I called Norman one day and mentioned that I was interested in seeing if he felt okay about me writing a book about these seven practices that he spoke about at Google. And of course, Norman paused and said, "What seven practices? I have no idea what you're talking about."
Can you repeat the seven just for a moment? Because I love them so much.
Yeah, yeah. Which I repeated to Norman on that phone call. Love the work. Do the work. Don't be an expert. Connect to your pain. Connect to the pain of others, depend on others, and keep making it simpler. And when I read them to Norman on that phone call, he said, "Those are pretty good.
Yeah, they're great.
And good luck. Good luck with your book. And please do send me a copy." And so that's it's funny. And then Norman and I actually were teaching together at Green Gulch just a couple of days ago, and kind of weaving in these practices, and as well as Norman has a new book out about imagination and the Bodhisattva path. So, you know, kind of it felt almost full circle, spending the day co-teaching together.
But that's real generosity too, rather than saying, "Hey, those are great. Give them back to me." They're mine.
Totally. Yeah. It was completely. Norman and I have been very, very close, and we teach together. We've been teaching together out of Green Gulch. We do these one-day workshops called Company Time, which are kind of this retreats for business people that we've been doing, I think, since 1995 now.
I'm wondering if when you go into a company, well, you obviously use the word love because you start with love the work. But do you use concepts openly, like love or compassion?
Totally, totally. I might not start there, and depending on the corporate setting. But I think I definitely start with getting people to just be quiet, and getting people to listen to their voices. And I might have people, like, starting with a a guided meditation. I might ask people to check in with their own mm-hmm. hearts and ask people to check in with what they love. And then I often like to do, have people practice listening. And a great place to start is to ask people to have a conversation. What do you love about your work? What do you love about your life? And what are some of your biggest challenges? What are you grappling with? And I think those are great starting places for teaching mindfulness in the business world.
What do you think, since you're using the mechanism of talking about leadership, what do you think our general cultural concept is of leadership, and how accurate is it?
That's a great question. I think in our culture, leadership has, there's a lot of, I think, cynicism and negative connotations that go with leadership. And it's complicated. Like people, that question makes me think of, often I'm teaching, mindfulness and emotional intelligence mm-hmm. in the business world. And one of the questions I get asked most often is, well, what about Steve Jobs, mm-hmm. right? That he's an example of someone, I think, who people think of, on the one hand, incredibly, dedicated, creative, like masterfully creative, right? Change the world, right? Here I am talking. Mm-hmm. I'm talking on an iPhone right now, which is kind of a miraculous invention of Steve Jobs and a whole team of people creation. On the other hand, he was known as being a really difficult person, that had a real shadow side. And I would often answer that question just by saying that I think he had some incredibly great leadership qualities, and he had a real shadow side. And I think a lot of people were hurt by his leadership style, which I think despite how difficult he was as a person, he managed to get people to rally around creating something. And I would ask the question, I wonder what other great things might have happened if he were even a more integrated and aligned leader. But these humans are complicated. People are complicated. I think now I think there is more and more interest and need in what I think of as integrated leadership, of people integrating things like love and compassion in with the ability to inspire others, the ability to have the kind of creative mind that Steve Jobs had. And it's kind of, I have to say, I did an interview the other day on these seven practices. It was a short radio mm-hmm. interview, and at the end, the person interviewing me said, "Can I ask you a personal question?" And I said, "Sure." And he said, "How does it make you feel that our president seems to exhibit the exact opposite of all seven mm-hmm. practices that you've just talked about?" And I said, it kind of breaks mm-hmm. my heart, actually, that we're not seeing the, at very high levels, especially in government. And I think in we see it in many corporate settings where these seven practices that I just named are not the kinds of ways of being that a lot of our leaders aspire to. Having said that, I keep seeing it more and more. I've noticed that Jeff Weiner of mm-hmm. Of LinkedIn is about to be doing a workshop on compassion mm-hmm. in Silicon Valley. And I think there's more and more interest in these aspirational practices. And I think on many levels, I think people realize we're in trouble. Our planet is in trouble. Our government is in trouble. Our corporations are in trouble. And that it's going to be people, I think, taking and embodying these kinds of practices mm-hmm. might be the only way out, the only way that we're going to solve some of these real problems, I think, is through more awake, more compassionate leaders.
And I think there's also, you know, there's the very classical kind of conventional sense of the leader as a single figure on top mm-hmm. of a pyramid, you know, and just in something you were just saying, I was reminded of when I was involved through the Garrison Institute in this 4-year program for domestic violence shelter workers, bringing the tools of yoga and meditation to them. And at some point, we started with frontline workers, and then at some point, directors and supervisors of shelters asked to have a program. So we did a kind of parallel program for them. And they came up with a slogan, you know, themselves, which was they wanted to start a culture of wellness at work. And for different shelters, that interestingly, like for everybody, that meant some physical space where you could just chill, you know. And for different shelters, it also meant different things, like maybe a rooftop garden or whatever. And I realized that culture could be your own body and mind. It could be your desk. It could be your team. It could be your whole shelter. And that every single person, whatever their position in the organization, had the potential to affect a culture of some kind. And so maybe in that way, we all have a role in leadership, no matter what function we're playing.
Totally. And that's, you know, I sometimes hesitate to use the word mm-hmm. leadership because it seems to conjure right a certain idea. But I think that everyone's a leader. And interesting that you should say what you just did. The theme of this workshop that Norman and I did just a few days ago at Green Gulch was looking at each person as what culture are you mm-hmm. creating? What are your underlying attitudes and assumptions that you are bringing, and what culture, what are the gaps in the culture that you've created, and what culture do you want to create? And I think it really does start there, and that then it becomes immensely interesting and often complex when you then put a variety of cultures together. Mm-hmm. What's the culture then of your team? You know, maybe it's or your partner, even a relationship. Mm-hmm. Any relationship is like that, right? Every relationship bringing how hard it is, right? This is why intimate relationships or and marriage or any close relationship is because you're actually taking more than one culture and putting them together. And then what to me is that's how I see the workplace. You're putting all these different cultures mm-hmm. together, and then you're asking people to actually get stuff done, right? That you have to actually work together. You have to collaborate on projects and agree on things. And those cultures, those individual cultures are being played out, and you need to work with them in a way that is hopefully working toward kind of individual and group sense of well-being.
That's great. So I have one more question, then I'm going to ask you to lead us in a short meditation. Because when I teach meditation, fixated on the moment that we realize we've been distracted, and that being a very important moment, not to just get down on ourselves, but to practice letting go and being able to begin again. And so I know in your book, you speak about a leader's ability to embrace failure. And I think of meditation practice as learning of resilience. You know, it's really learning how to begin again over and over again. So I wonder if you could just say something about our relationship to failure.
Yeah, I'm kind of reflecting on kind of in what we were talking about how, right, from an individual level, right? So this is the third practice is don't be an expert, mm-hmm. Which in a way is shifting our relationship with failure, and as you were saying about how I'm somehow imagining that you and I are teach meditation fairly there's more mm-hmm. similarities mm-hmm. I imagine than there are mm-hmm. differences. Yeah, and that part of it is right that we're you come back again and again to noticing your breath, and of course you will fail at that. And then, well, what is your attitude? Can you just say, I'm my thinking mind is happening, and I've totally lost track of my breath, and I'm going to, and this is a little bit like, I think, I'll often even use Dogen's word here with a grandmother mm-hmm. mind, with a mind of acceptance and love. Can you gently bring your attention back to being with the breath? And then taking that and expanding upon it, you know, I think, there's lots of, there's lots of failure in the world of work. People tend to avoid it. We tend to, nobody wants to fail, but there are thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of companies that fail every year. And then there are people who are not in the right job and leave or leave their job. And there is just so much failure. And I think the practice of shifting our relationship from whether it's focusing on our breath or these more bigger, more profound failures of businesses that fail or projects that fail. And it's this, in some way, it's this shift from a judgmental kind of more fixed mindset to a mindset of open-heartedness and seeing that we're always learning and that failure is just part of the game, part of being a human being.
That's great. So would you like to lead us in a short practice?
I would be delighted to. Should we, about 5 minutes,
is perfect.
Is that a good
yeah.
time? Okay. Well, thank you. I just want to appreciate you for a moment. Thank you for inviting me here, and thank you for the good work that you've been doing for, seems like, many lifetimes now.
Thank you so much.
So let's start by stopping. Stopping, pausing is such a great practice. Noticing the transition from listening, whatever you may have been doing, to stopping. What is it like to stop? What is it like to bring your attention to the body, to the breath? Again, a kind of checking in, tuning in, noticing your shoulders and chest and face and neck, just really being in the body, starting with the body, making conscious choices about placing the hands and feet. Maybe sitting up just a little straighter, if that's comfortable, putting some energy in the spine, energy in the upper back. Feeling the sense of alertness, awakeness, sitting perhaps like a majestic mountain, a feeling of dignity in the body. And at the same time, being relaxed, comfortable. That alone, just a great practice, being relaxed and alert. And then gently, I invite you to bring your attention to the breath, noticing that breathing is happening without us having to do anything. Just gently noticing that breathing in and breathing out. And even bringing a sense of curiosity. Knowing, noticing that this breath is actually new and fresh. This breath right now has never happened before, won't ever happen again. So bringing a kind of attention, curiosity, even some kindness to the breath, to the body, without trying to change anything, just noticing. And you might be curious, bring that curiosity to your thinking mind as well, noticing whether your mind is busy or calm, and whatever it is, just noticing and gently seeing if you can bring your attention back to the breath, to the body. So just cultivating this sense of right now, there's nothing lacking, nothing extra is needed, just breathing in and breathing out. Can you feel your own sense of safety, appreciation, and connection? Can you feel there's no separateness between us right now? And keeping it simple, just noticing the in-breath and out-breath, noticing what it's like to be alive, to be here right now. And then let's gently bring our attention back to being here, here with each other. And thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much for doing that. And thank you all for joining us today.
Really appreciate it. And I look forward to the next time that we can meet, maybe even in
person.
That
would be so great. Maybe not even in a large conference, which it usually is.
That would be lovely. Yeah.
Great. So if you would like to learn more about Mark, you can visit his website at www.marklesser, that's MarkLesser.net. And I encourage you to check out his new book, Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader, which is available in paperback, ebook, and audiobook formats wherever books are sold. Thank you.
Hey, folks. Thanks for listening. To learn more about Sharon and her ongoing teaching schedule, as well as online courses and a free guided meditation, check out her website at sharonsalzberg.com.